I got a letter during the week where someone was asking me, basically, which is the best Buddhist tradition and how can you find out? Because they gave me some pamphlet from some teacher who was the supreme master. And it started me thinking about some of the experiences I have had in all this supreme or the best or the most. I remember a couple of years ago, I went to Cambodia for a big Buddhist summit and I was representing the Australian Buddhist community there. And so when they gave me a little card, which you have to wear in these conferences, it was VVIP. I said, what does that mean? And that meant very, very important. And oh my goodness. You know, it started off with just being a person. And then just IP would be enough. That'd be pretty good to get important person. And then you get VIP, which is very important person, but that's not good enough these days. So you have to have very, very important person. And as soon as they gave me that, I was looking out to see who had VVVIP. There's no end to this sort of spiritual elitism or like, you know, pride. You know, that sometimes even the, you know, sometimes you call yourself Venerable Brahma Wangsa, but in another conference which I've been going to, you know, because, you know, that I've been a monk for many years, you know, everyone is a venerable, so you have to be something different. So they call them most venerable, whatever that means. But not everyone could be the most venerable. If you think logically, only one person can be the most venerable. But maybe you can put more venerable. But then, of course, you have an extreme venerable and the most extreme venerable. The point is that why is it that we have this tendency in human beings to always actually to up the ante, to give ourselves more titles, to compare and always to compare ourselves in such a way as puts us above others? What is this thing about elitism and always wanting to be superior than the church or the temple down the road or the person down the road? And this is going to be the subject of this talk this evening because it becomes quite confusing to many people. Why is it that people of religion are actually getting into this game of like spiritual elitism or superiority? It doesn't really make sense when you understand that the heart of all spiritual practices of religions, if you like, is supposed to be so understanding this thing we call ego and not taking it so seriously and actually even undermining its very nature, its existence. One of the central features of Buddhism is the idea of no self. And so if everyone understood no self or the emptiness, how can we actually keep comparing ourselves of being better or even worse? And indeed, that in traditional Buddhism, Buddhism made it very, very clear that, you know, there are something called the three types of conceit. And a conceit, you know, is like a conceiving, like a thought, a measurement. And I was very fascinated the first time I heard this to read. But it's not just the conceit that I am better than somebody else. It's even the Buddha was very clear and very wise, said even the conceit that you're the same as other people is also a conceit. And the third conceit is that you're worse than other people. And those both are just an elitism or a sameness or like a worseness, which the Buddha said is all based on the delusion of measuring. Because when you look very deeply into the nature of, you know, your being, the nature of life, the nature of this world, then it becomes impossible to actually to compare anybody. Sometimes when we talk about elitism, yeah, sure, there's some people know more than somebody else. There's some people who are better meditators than others. Now, my monastery is getting quite full now, and we just wonder just what to do as more and more people are ordaining. We've only got a limit of 20 monks at our monastery, so I thought at the end of every year we'll give them a test, an examination, who can meditate the longest, and therefore the ones who fail can get booted out. As everyone is sitting there, and I'm sitting with my stopwatch, waiting to see who's moving first. But of course, that's only a joke. You could never do that because how can you measure? Just because a person sits a long time doesn't mean that they're a better meditator. And that's what sometimes happened. When I was a young monk, I started thinking, oh, just see how long you can meditate for. And I started off with 20 minutes and then I started, you know, working towards the 25 minutes. So when I made 30 minutes, that was a big landmark. But then I wasn't going to stop with just 30 minutes. I was going to go for 40 minutes, even though it almost killed me when I first started. And then you got to an hour. Once you got to an hour, then it's very easy to go for 2 hours or 3 hours. And then you start thinking, how many hours have you meditated? And sometimes you talk to other young monks. Only 3 hours, that's nothing. I meditated for 5 hours. And then when Ajahn Chah started hearing about this, that's when he told this wonderful story. Because Ajahn Chah was just full of this very easy to understand but profound teachings, which were incredibly funny. He said, listen, monks, you're always trying to compare just how long you sit for. If sitting for long periods was essential to becoming enlightened, then all the chickens in this world would now be enlightened because they sit for more hours than you do on their eggs. They don't even have a soft zafu, a cushion to sit on. They sit on these hard, bony eggs for hours and hours and hours. So I remember that. And you know, I've looked at many chickens and they're certainly not enlightened. So the amount of time you meditate for, you're just making yourself a chicken. And maybe if you sit for long periods like that, not getting any depth in your meditation, maybe next lifetime you might be reborn as a chicken. Nevertheless, the point is that, you know, he saw quite clearly that it was just like a spiritual one-upmanship. Who can sit the longest? And sometimes I just recall, like, just being a school teacher and looking at some of the different children in the classes which you were teaching, and sure that some people were at the top of the class, some people were at the bottom of the class. But what did that really matter when you started to inquire into, you know, where they come from, what they've been doing? And often I thought, well, look at the whole school, the big picture in a school. You get kids in there from year 7 to year 12 in a high school. Sure, the children in grade 12 know much more than the children in grade 7, but that's understandable. They've been in school longer. What do you expect? But it doesn't mean the children in grade 12 are better than the children in grade 7. Sure, they know more. And they may be more skilled, but that doesn't mean the word better or worse. Just different, that's all. And when you start looking at the way we compare each other and who's the best and who's the worst, it becomes quite clear it's logically untenable. How can you compare a grade 12 child to a grade 7 child? How can you compare just a man with a woman? How can you compare a monk with a layperson? Because sometimes people say, oh, you monks, you sit up here. And, you know, you guys and girls have to sit down there. That's just elitism. And it's not elitism, it's just practicality. You would not be able to see me if I sat down there. That's all it is. So a lot of times, sometimes, that we misunderstand and we try and encourage this elitism. I am better than you. It's untenable, but more than that, it's incredibly dangerous. And it's a danger which comes from, like, the measuring of better and worse, which causes the biggest difficulties in our world. Because as soon as actually one person says you're better than the others, there's always a conflict there. You can see in our world, especially in religions, that sometimes that, you know, one part of a religion thinks that they've got the best teachings, the Shias and the Sunnis of in Iraq. They're both Muslims, but they think that theirs is the real one, the other isn't, that I'm better and you're worse. And what happens when you have that comparison of better and worse? We end up arguing with each other, the arguing turns to violence, we blow up each other's temples. Fortunately, we haven't got that far yet in Buddhism, but hopefully the different strands of Buddhism never get that far that we end up sort of saying, you're really bad, we're the best one, and we're going to go and destroy you. That is completely untenable, but this is actually where the comparisons lead to. The betters and the worse. And those measurements, it's a strange thing, but the closer you are in your beliefs, or in your religion, or in your philosophies, or in even in your relationship, the people coming together, the closer you are, the more friction there is, and the more antagonism. So I've seen this so many times that, let's say, even in Buddhism, Buddhism can be so friendly with Christians, and with Hindus, but you get to Buddhists, one from Mahayana or Theravada or Zen or whatever, and they have big arguments on which one is the right Buddhism. Why is it the closer we are, the more we argue? And I remember hearing a joke about that some time ago. Here comes today's joke. About this man, he was walking home one night across a bridge and he saw this guy about to jump off the bridge, commit suicide. He went up to him and said, "What are you doing that for? Please don't do that. I'm a Christian. I've come to help you." And the man on the bridge about to jump off said, "I'm a Christian too." And the sort of the do-gooder said, "Oh, what type of Christianity?" And the man said, "I'm a Baptist." He said, "Oh, that's amazing. I'm a Baptist too. So what type of baptism, Southern Reformed or the Northern?" He said, "I'm a Southern Baptist." "Wow, amazing. Same as me." So the 1926 agreement or the 1964 agreement? He said, "I'm a 1926 agreement." "So that's amazing. So am I," said the guy who was trying to help him. 1926 agreement, second time revised? "No," he said, "I'm a 1926 agreement, third time revised." "You are, you heretic," and he pushed him off the bridge. Now, the middle of that story is they're so close together, the closer we are together, the more angry we get at each other. The big differences don't seem to matter so much, but the small differences we fight to the death over. Why is that? And again, you can actually see that there's a mind which measures, which creates all these problems. And it becomes what we call this spiritual elitism. And it does create the problems and the wars and the violence outside of yourself. It stops us being friends. How can you really be a friend to someone else when you think you are so much better than they are? That you are more venerable than they are? Or more wise than they are? Or more enlightened than they are? It's wonderful that in our monastery we do not have spiritual exams at the end of the year. In meditation classes, I never actually hold up these cards like they do at the Commonwealth Games, gymnastics, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and grade people. And you do that on purpose because it's impossible to grade people and it does not make sense grading those people. Even in one human being, how can you measure yourself and to say today I had a good meditation, yesterday I had a bad meditation? How can you compare? When you look at all the conditions and the causes which bring about this moment, sometimes you think that you could have done better or you could have done worse. The truth of the matter is you couldn't have done anything else. This is the way it was. And you're just expressing the conditions of your life. So how can you measure that? When we try and measure other people, we're not understanding them. How often has it happened to you that someone has criticized you because you've come home, stayed late from work, and you promised to be home early, but you tried your very best, but the conditions just stopped it happening. And you feel that you are being criticized, they're getting angry at you, and you know you're being unfairly criticized. It happens so often that we feel we're unfairly judged, that the person never really understood us. But how often is it when you're unfairly praised? You think, "Oh no, I don't deserve that," and you get upset because you're judged. We only get upset when we criticize badly, but when somebody praises us for something we didn't do, "Oh, thank you very much indeed." That's why some of the stories which I tell, they're not really jokes, but you still laugh because I got them wrong. But I still get very happy about it. The point being here is that when we have this thing called praise and blame, which is a part of this elitism, that we can actually understand that what we praise and what we blame, we're not really understanding. And in fact, you can't really praise or blame much at all in this world because this is just what people are, what people do. It's part of their conditioning. But you can understand what happens with praise and blame in the world. Sometimes people come up to me and said that this person said this or they did that. It's very unfair. Why did it happen to me? And of course, the answer is why not? It happens to everybody. We often get blamed for things we didn't do. And we often get praised for things we didn't do as well. This is part of life. It's par for the course. You can accept it. So when you get unfairly criticized, you think, ah, yes, thank you very much. I expected that. Can you do that? A lot of problems in life is actually false expectations of life. And we have unrealistic expectations. We're not really living in a real world. The realistic expectations is understanding that other people will misunderstand us sometimes. They will praise us for things we didn't do and blame us for things we didn't do. We should understand that and accept that and not get up angry and think that something has gone wrong. In the same way that when we understand that praise and blame, what the Buddha called worldly dhammas, nothing to do with the spiritual life, is coming from a deluded mind, we can actually stop. If we're going to do anything, for those that are both deluded, if you're going to do anything, praise is much better than blame. You get much more out of a person when you praise them than when you blame them. So just, if you're going to be deluded in the praising. You get much further in life by sucking up to people than you do by blaming them. And it's a little bit of praise actually can actually help change people's views. This was actually in an article which I saw recently, that if you actually praise someone, make them feel good, they're more open to listening. So if you are going to be talking with your husband, your wife, with your parent or someone about something very difficult, praise them first of all. Suck up to them. Make them feel good. And then when they are open, when they're listening, then you can maybe talk to them about some difficult thing. Even they're changing their view. It was a psychology experiment which was done. When you're kind to a person, praise them, look after them, then they're more likely to change their opinion about something than when you confront them directly. So if you're going to do anything, praise is much better than blame. But in the deeper nature of things, that both are completely deluded. You can't praise a person, you can't blame a person. Sometimes you don't know why they do these things. No more than what you do can sometimes, how can you praise or blame? So when we have an elitism, who's the best meditator? Who's the wisest person? Who's the best? Then sometimes you can't really judge fairly. And it wouldn't be a wonderful world if we didn't have such elitism. And instead we could have understanding instead. But what is the barrier to that? And the barrier to that is always this terrible thing we call a self inside of us. And this self inside of us always wants to actually to exist, to impress, to be, to get people's accolades. Why is it that people in those Commonwealth Games work so hard, ran so hard, put themselves through so much pain to do what they did? I recall one of my fellow monks, his best friend was a champion athlete. He was always winning these long distance races again and again and again. They thought he was like an Olympic gold medal possibility for England. And then he just lost a race and he never won anymore since that time. He just retired. And when he asked him, so how come you lost that race? And he just replied, I realized I didn't need to win. For all his time up until that race, he always thought he had to win. He must win. And he put himself through so much pain and agony every time he was killing himself. And he got this wonderful realization, this almost enlightenment. I don't need to win. And from that time on, he never won any sprint races, but he certainly was a winner of the human race. He had contentment. He had peace. He was at ease with himself, and he got happiness. So, do you want to win the race? Are you trying to be a winner? If you are, why? Where's that coming from? And what's it doing to you? If you want to be a winner in this world and want to be the best, if you are trying to become the most venerable in the monastery and the most enlightened member of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, if you want to be the holiest person in the whole of Australia, Then you're really asking for a lot of trouble. It is that spiritual elitism. Sometimes that people give up the worldly elitism of trying to be a winner in the world. And they come along and try and be a winner in their religion. And first of all, they want to choose the best monastery or the best teacher. And they go along and say, who's your teacher? And you say, I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. I said, here, oh, that's terrible. I'm a disciple of a much more enlightened person than that. And sometimes people talk like this, as if your teacher confers upon you some sort of elitism or lack of it. And because of that some teachers actually say that only come to me, don't go to anybody else, which is an elitism which breeds a cult. A cult is some place where you go, and you can only go to that place. You're forbidden from going to other teachings. You can't read other books. It is a possessiveness, like a prison, which some religions or spiritual teachings sometimes do. And I told someone just before coming in here, he said, you don't just have one teacher in life. No more than when you go to school, you only have one teacher who teaches you everything from English to maths to science to geography to the foreign languages and everything else. At a school, you have many teachers because one teacher is very good at one subject and they're not so good at other subjects. But can you compare the history teacher to the maths teacher? In life, we have many teachers and everyone will complement each other. And when they complement each other, you learn much more, you grow much more. If you're digging a well, you can't just use a spade. Sometimes a spade, sometimes a pick, sometimes a bucket to take the earth out. You need many different tools to dig a well in the same way. To learn the spiritual depths, the truths which are found deep inside of you, in the well within the heart. We do need many tools to dig out this truth of peace, of freedom, of enlightenment, of love. And that is why the elitism which says, just come to my centre and don't go to other people's centre, is wrong. In fact, I've been saying this for a long time now. As a teacher myself, I'm trying my hardest to get rid of disciples. Just like I was a teacher at school, I was trying to get rid of my students. By getting rid of them, I mean they graduate, they didn't need to come back again. But I have some very stupid students. Some of you have been coming back here for the last 20 years, every Friday night, and you still haven't learned enough to sort of not need to come here anymore. I must be a terrible teacher. But the point is, isn't a successful teacher someone who gets rid of their disciples? Not actually amasses anymore. So the whole idea is actually for, instead of an elitism where you say, just come to my monastery or my church, the real good teachers to say, go to the other church, don't come here. In other words, they don't really say that. They say, just see whatever teaching works for you. And don't just think that one teacher or one tradition or even in one religion. Why not to see if there's other things available? I don't really care sort of what tradition it is. If they say something useful, wise, conducive to peace, to happiness, to freedom, for understanding, why not listen and put it into practice? And I state the Buddha's teachings there. He said, whatever leads to such things as peace, to happiness, to freedom, to tolerance, to unconditional love, he said, that must be the good teaching. That's Dhamma. He called that the teachings of a Buddha. So you know it not from where it comes from. You know it not from what it sounds like. You know it from where it leads. If it leads to such beautiful things as peace, freedom, harmony, you know that it must be truth. And you know that you can get that truth from many places in the world. The point is, you don't compare one teacher to another teacher, nor one religion to another religion, not one history teacher to one maths teacher, but you can learn from each other. More than that, as someone just asked me earlier, they said, can you be my teacher? And I said, I will not be your teacher. I will be a teacher for you, but not the teacher. Because sometimes when you become the teacher, there becomes a transference of responsibility from the disciple to that person. And that is both unfair on the teacher and it's also dysfunctional for the student. The whole purpose of a religious path or a spiritual path is not to take your power away from you, not to tell you what to do, because that is part of the elitism, that I know more than you, that I am more enlightened than you, that I've got more power than you, so you have to do what you're told. Even though that sometimes I would love to have that. When I went to visit the Benedictine monastery in New Norcia, I've been there many times, I know the monks very well, and they're friends. But what I was very interested, being an abbot, and Abbot Placid being the abbot of the Benedictine monastery, was some of their rules and ways of doing things. The one thing they have, which we don't have in our Buddhist monasteries, is the rule of obedience. And I thought, that's an interesting rule to... It was very attractive being the leader of a monastery to actually have obedience. But I would never do that because it's against the spirit of Buddhism to have that degree of obedience and that degree of control. The whole point of Buddhism is a freeing of the individual, not a disempowering of them. And actually controlling does disempower another person. So even though there's part of me would say that'd be a great rule to have in our monastery, the other part of me, which is the wiser part, this is the lazy part, wants to have obedience. I'd have a much easier life. But even here, that sometimes, that once apparently I did a spelling error when I was wrote on a piece of paper that I was a spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It was a typo, but one of those things you call a Freudian slip. I wrote down spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. That's a nice joke, but that can't be the way of things. Because that degree of controlling would mean that somehow I thought that I was somehow better than other people, and somehow that I was privileged or somehow empowered to create such a role for myself. And that would always lead to a lot of difficulties and problems. And it's against the whole purpose of spirituality, which is to free the individual, not to bind them in a power relationship between somebody who knows and somebody who doesn't. Even in a school these days, sure, the teacher has the authority, but the authority of the wisdom or the knowledge of a teacher is something which is imparted to the student to free them so they don't need to rely on their teacher anymore. It's a freeing and empowering of the other person so they can be independent. Well, the word we have in the teacher-student relationship in Buddhism, in monastic Buddhism, they say it's like a word which we call nisaya, which literally means resting on or leaning on. My role as a teacher to my young monks in my monastery is they lean on me for a while. Just like you can lean on a sort of a crutch until you're strong enough to do without it. But it's not a disempowering, it's a sort of a temporary support for other people. And that should always be the role of a teacher, to support, but always temporarily, to inspire and lead and instruct and share wisdom, but never to tell you what to do. And I make this point very strongly, and you may notice that this is an important part of the Buddhist teachings. We never rule from on top about what the right thing or the wrong thing is with things like abortion or on euthanasia, or tell you what the right thing or the wrong thing to do with your sexual life. As Buddhists, we can only empower you, can give you good advice to make up your own decisions. That always has to be the case. It's empowering you, not telling you what to do, but helping you make your own decisions. And that is a good sign that this is not an elitism, not to say that I know much more than you, that I have got some revelation from some divine being or some transmission which means that I can tell you what to do. That is an elitist type of village. An elite force which knows much more and which just tells you. It may sound easier for you to actually to have this authority and to believe in that authority, but the person who truly knows would never assume such authority. Because if they do, it just leads to this terrible, terrible one-upmanship and this infighting amongst the elite, which will always happen. So who's the most elite? And who's the supreme, most elitist of the group? And that is one of the problems with our world. So instead of having an aristocracy in a religion or an elitist in religion. We understand that the different parts of Buddhism or the different teachings, the different teachers, the different traditions, instead of actually opposing each other and who's the best, we don't compare, but we make use of. In the same way, we never say that a rose is more beautiful than a daffodil, but they all belong in the garden next to each other if you know how to arrange them together. We allow them all to be as part of the tapestry of our spiritual life. And that way that we don't need to fight or feel either aggressive or defensive against other people who come and say, our religion is much better than your religion. Instead, we can say that our religions are okay, instead of mine and yours. And when we can have that degree of tolerance, you can see how much we can have a peaceful world. We won't measure anymore. And when we stop measuring anymore, we'll have much more freedom because we realize how can you do this measuring business. And if someone comes along and say, my religion's better than yours, and you come along and say, no, my religion's better than yours, you're going to get into an argument which no one is ever going to win. And of course, these days, you know, there are some very aggressive religious people. And sometimes they come and sometimes it's good fun sometimes because life as a monk can be very peaceful. And sometimes when someone comes and argues with you because they're a born-again Christian, sometimes it's good fun having them come along and sort of start messing around. And there's many sort of interesting stories about born-again Christians. And this one monk was telling me that he was in a train in UK somewhere going on a long journey, and one of these evangelicals saw the great opportunity to go to heaven quickly, convert a Buddhist monk, especially a Buddhist teacher. And that must really get you into good stance with God after you die, if that's what you believe in. And so he came up to him and tried to convert him. And all the time, this monk was just being kind and being gentle while all the other people in the carriage were being entertained. Because it's very boring being on a train in UK, going from place to place. And when this evangelical Christian and Buddhist were going head to head, it's like one of these reality TV shows to see who's going to win. And so they were going off together. And in the end, the monk was just so peaceful and calm. And in the end, he said, this is my stop now. You know, I love you. This Buddhist monk said to this evangelical Christian man, he said, isn't that what all religions are about? And everyone cheered in the carriage, and he left. Just with those words, he won. And just simple things like that, not saying that I'm better than you, but saying a love which is actually binds us together instead of being better or worse. And that's why he won the argument there. Because how can there be an argument when you don't compare? How many arguments do you have in your life? And is it always somehow or other, is a better or a worse, a should and shouldn't, a good and a bad, which comes up there? And after a while, you see all these arguments which we have in the world, all these political problems which you have in places like Thailand and France and other countries in the world. And sometimes you say, what's going on here? Can't people actually learn how to be at peace and actually to discuss things properly and kindly? Why is it? And it's just because of this ego thing. I'm better than you. I know more than you. I'm right and you're wrong, which means we never listen to each other. We just become, I have got the best truth. Your truth doesn't really count. And it's an elitism, which I know and you don't know. So instead of that, we can stop this spiritual elitism and actually just learn how to be at peace and to listen. When you learn how to listen, you can listen from anybody. I know that one time that somebody asked the Buddha just before he passed away, and this was a very beautiful teaching which gives a great answer about religious harmony and diversity. They asked him, is it possible to become enlightened in other traditions outside of Buddhism? It's a great question which is pertinent today. Can you become enlightened in other traditions? And the Buddha gave this beautiful answer. He said, in whatever tradition you have things like an Eightfold Path, a practice of virtue, of meditation, development of wisdom, yeah, sure, you'll find enlightened people. What he was saying was, it's not the name of the tradition, it's actually what you do makes you enlightened or not enlightened. It's not your belief structure, it's actually your actions, your practice. That is what leads to enlightenment. And this is so true, because sometimes people can belong to a particular church or a particular temple and think that that's enough. And it's not. It's what you do there is most important. And what you do is more important than what you pretend. Even in places like Thailand, I remember these monasteries in Thailand where all these Thais were supposed to be devout Buddhists. Sure that they were devout on the outside, but on the inside there was something different. And we found this out once when these Thai people, these Thai lay people, were keeping the five precepts. Some of you Buddhists have kept the five precepts, and sometimes you've gone to ceremonies and you've seen the monks giving the five precepts. We put our hands up and we, you know, we do the Namo Tassa and the three refuges and the five precepts, you know, refrain from deliberately killing living beings. And this is such an important ceremony that it's done in most Buddhist events. And you can actually see this every Saturday and Sunday here at Nolamara at the lunchtime. We always give those five precepts. And once we saw these Thai people taking the five precepts and they had one finger down. And in all the years which I've been in Thailand, I've never seen this before. What does it mean, like, you know, putting one finger down? And when we asked them, they said, oh, today, Venerable Sir, I'm only keeping four precepts. But nevertheless, they chanted all the five precepts. It was one way of actually preserving their ego, because they were chanting everything like everybody else, but keeping one finger down. And once I saw that, I started looking even more carefully. And sure enough, I saw someone with two fingers down. And after many weeks, I looked, and sure enough, I found someone with all their fingers down. They were still chanting all the precepts, but they weren't meaning to keep them. And what were they doing that for? It's just because ego, pride, they were just, and on the surface, Buddhists. They weren't real Buddhists. They weren't really spiritual people. They were just playing. And it's not what you say. It's not whether you go to the temple or you don't go to the temple. It's not if you're a Sri Lankan. You always say, I'm a Buddhist because I'm a Sri Lankan. It's what you do is important. If anybody does actually practice, the Eightfold Path is virtuous conduct, which means not doing anything which harms yourself and or harms another person. And being a spiritual aristocrat is straight away harming yourself, thinking I am better than other people. I've been meditating for so long. Sometimes, you know, you can actually, you know, we could do this actually here in our Buddhist society. We can find out how long you've been a member of the Buddhist Society of WA. And the members have been here for 20 years. You can actually stand in the front. This is the 20-year-old. And the 10-year-old is back over there. And the 5-year-old. And those people who've only just joined, you sit outside. We don't have that aristocracy sort of, you know, in our temples. They do have that in the churches, because I remember just seeing the front row is always, they've got a little crown on it in St. George's Cathedral. That's, you know, for royalty. Always sit at the front. I was very, very pleased in the times I was in Thailand that whether you were royalty or a general or a very wealthy person, sometimes you sat at the back. And the villagers who were dirt poor, who had hardly, you know, a few baht, that's a Thai currency, to their name, they sat right in the front. And I thought, why is this? And they say, well, in a monastery, if you're going to sit in the front, it's because of your precepts. No, because of your virtue. That's what really counts in a monastery. So if there is any hierarchy, it's, you know, your virtue you can sit in the front. As soon as they went outside, then, so the generals and the important people, the prime ministers, then they were up front and the villagers were right down. It's wonderful that if you're going to respect anything, to respect virtue rather than wealth or rather than prestige. So it's great having a place like this. You know, if a very wealthy person, a famous person comes in, it doesn't matter. They don't sit in the front. They can sit wherever they can. It's great, you know, being like that as a monk. I remember going to give a talk in Sydney some years ago. And there was only a small group of maybe about 20, 30 people teaching the meditation. This lady was looking at me. She was in like a young, attractive lady looking at me. And I don't know why she was looking at me. I was getting a bit worried after a little while, looking at me all the time. And then afterwards, I asked the organizer, why is that lady looking at me all the time? And she said, don't you know her? I think she was some TV star in Water Rats or something. And she's very, very, very popular. Everybody knows her except me because I never watch a TV. And so she was looking at me just to try and be recognized. And I didn't recognize her. And that apparently that made her really upset. because she was so used to being recognized, that was her ego, that was her position in society, that was her elitism of being a famous person. So at least as a in Buddhism, we don't have this spiritual aristocracy. It's one of the reasons why, and this is, for those who have been coming a long time, that monks never let on how deep their meditation is or how enlightened they are or what psychic powers they have. We keep this very quiet for the one reason that we don't want to start an aristocracy of monks or nuns within the Sangha. So you just don't know what the monks are up to inside. And the reason is because the Buddha wanted to make at least the group of monks and nuns even, without splitting them up into the enlightened ones and the dummies. Because you can imagine what happens, you know, if you did have that degree of elitism. Sometimes that, unfortunately, that people assume that certain monks are enlightened. And this is what happened. My master, Ajahn Chah, everyone always thought that he was enlightened. He was a great arahat. And it's true. You get more good karma by offering to an enlightened being than you do offering to an ordinary Job monk. So what would happen in these early days when the food was so scarce that sometimes you did just get a ball of rice and a frog on top? That on this one occasion, I remember sitting there just expecting such a disgusting meal, which is the only one meal of the day, day after day after day. But you knew when Ajahn Chah was in the monastery, lots of people would come because he was an enlightened being, so they thought, and so they'd bring all the delicious food to him. So there I was sitting there, and one day this big truck came in, had pots and pots of food from town. This is stuff you could eat, not the village food. And I thought, great, I'm going to have a good meal today. But the driver got out of their car and said, is Ajahn Chah here today? I'm sorry, he's gone to another monastery. So they turned around and went home. We got nothing. And that hurt. Just had a frog and rice again. Yeah. Now you can understand just why you don't want that type of elitism. And it's true, you can't tell sometimes. One of my favorite stories from the time of the Buddha was when these monks who were going on alms round, and they had one of these small novices. If you've seen, gone to Thailand or Burma, you sometimes see these little fellows ordained as monks, maybe only 12 or 13. Sometimes it's because they've got no home to go to. They may be orphans or their parents are so poor. Or even sometimes they've been abused at home and they're so afraid they go to a monastery as a refuge. At least they get kindness and an education and looked after in a monastery. So in the time of the Buddha, this young man had become a monk and the senior monks were teasing him, as sometimes you do to young people. And the Buddha told those monks, come over here, you don't know who you're teasing. Because that little novice is only 12 or 13 years old. Actually, he was only 7 years old, I think he was. Sumana, his name was. He was fully enlightened with great psychic powers. And the Buddha told him a story that he'd done battle with this dragon who lived in one of the lakes up in the Himalayas and defeated him. And okay, you may not believe in those psychic stories, but that's part of the original Buddhism. Because you don't know what you've done. That monk is fully enlightened with great powers. Now, you can't know. And that's when he sort of told the story, like the thing, the four small things you'd always be careful of, like a small snake. Just because it's a baby snake doesn't mean it hasn't got great venom. It can kill you. Or a small fire, because a small fire can sometimes turn into a big bushfire, which can destroy hundreds and thousands of acres of property. Also, be careful of a small prince. There may be only a small prince, but one day they may take over the throne. And if you're in their kingdom and they remember what you've done, you'll be in big trouble, revenge. These days we say be careful of small politicians. And the last thing he said, be careful of small monks or nuns. Because sometimes you don't know, who they are, what they can do. And so because of that, you can understand that the Buddha's wanted to have this evenness, this lack of elitism within his group of monks. They call the Sangha or nuns. No superiority, inferiority, because that goes against the truth of the mind and the body. Just like in a school, you can't compare. It's just some people have been at the meditation longer. Not that they're better or worse. Surely they're more developed, while other people are less developed. It's only a matter of time. So we don't have this elitism of better or worse. When we don't have this elitism, better or worse, we never feel this inferiority or superiority. We feel this evenness, and that evenness, lack of superiority, inferiority, neither is really there. It means that we can actually love another person, be their friend, be their equal, be their partner, rather than being their boss. If ever you have superiority, inferiority, your relationship will be between a superior and inferior. You've probably seen that at work. You've had that in your life. Please don't have that in your home. If you do, you're going to have a terrible time there. We don't need to have that. In a monastery, sure, we have the different ways of seating. You know, senior and junior, according to the years you've been a monk, but that doesn't mean you're better or worse. And if we can do that in a monastery, if we can do that in a relationship, sure, we should have that in our religions. There's no such thing as a better or worse. It's just different, that's all. Which is sometimes why, that, you know, sometimes, even in Buddhism, sometimes they say, what are they doing this for? Sometimes they have all these different strands of Buddhism, whether it's Mahayana, Theravada, Zen, the forest tradition, the city tradition. I just remember this is a story from my own tradition, from Ajahn Chah's monastery. There was once this monk came to stay. He had these, I think Ajahn Chah was sick at this time. He had bright yellow robes. Now we have like the darker robes. And this is again sometimes superiority, inferiority. I had a much lighter robe, but it was wearing out, so I got this robe just last week. And so sometimes you have these monks with bright orange robe, and that signifies they're from the city. And so some of the forest monks were looking down upon the village monks or the city monks, saying, these monks, you know, they accept money, they probably eat three times a day, they watch the TV, and they're just that shameless monk, they probably never meditated. And so this monk came, and they just said, oh, you can just, you know, stay in the hall. And so he stayed there for 3 days. No one talked to him, and he went back again afterwards. We found out afterwards just how highly attained he was. He'd been attaining the third jhana, which is a very high, deep state of meditation. He wanted some instruction on how to go deeper. It was only because he was wearing sort of a robe, not of a forest tradition, that people assumed he wasn't a meditator. Even in my home temple, they made a huge mistake there. Why is it that we sometimes have these, even within a tradition, this superiority, inferiority business? Well, I'm the forest tradition. I'm Ajahn Chah's tradition. I'm the... Please never do that, because sometimes we miss the truth or we judge a person just from their tradition. The Buddha made a great point of this in his life. He wanted to destroy the caste system which was present in India at the time. He'd said very clearly, you can't judge a person by their family, who their father was, or where they were born. And even though he railed against the caste system in India, that was one area where he failed. The caste system survives to this day. But truly, how can you say that one person is better than another because, you know, the caste in which they were born, or the country where they were born, or the profession of their father? That goes against reason. And so how can we say that, you know, one person, because they're from the forest tradition, or because they're from the village tradition, or because they're from Zen, or because they're Mahayana, because they're from Pure Land, or because they're from Theravada, how can we say again that that person's a better person? It doesn't matter what tradition you're from. It's what you're doing in that tradition which counts. As the Buddha said, wherever you see the practice of the Eightfold Path, there you find enlightened beings. It's not the name of the path. It's not the tradition you come from. It's not the country or the lineage or the name of your teacher. What's important is what you're doing. It's the acts which define the person, not sort of these outer packaging. And that's the same with all the religions in our world. It's not that Islam is the best or Buddhism is the best or Christianity is the best. Is what the person is doing in those religions. And if they are really practicing virtue, They're not harming other people. They're not harming themselves. If you really are practicing the meditation, the way of inner peace, if you are really developing the wisdom which acknowledges the stillness, the peace, the freedom, the love, the unconditional awareness in life, then that is a path which will lead to enlightenment. And it cuts against all this spiritual elitism. It cuts against just how long you've meditated, how many initiations you've had, what teacher you are, how long you've been a Buddhist, how many hours you can meditate. It cuts against all of that stuff. After all, how can we really compare? I had another joke, and I better put it in now because otherwise I won't get it in. Of these four ladies from Cottesloe, which is for the internet, this is a western suburb, quite wealthy in Perth, and they were having morning coffee in Bayview Terrace. And there they were talking about their children, as such women do. And one of them said, "My child, he's just graduated from the seminary. I was going to say cemetery, but that's wrong word. I went to a funeral this afternoon. Only Buddhists graduate from the cemetery, they get reincarnated. He graduated from the seminary, and now he's a Catholic priest." And she was so proud of him. People actually, when he comes into a room, they get off their chairs. They stand up and say, "Your Reverence." You know what it's like, the one-upmanship in Cottesloe. The other lady said, "That's nothing. That's nothing. My son, he's a bishop. When he gets into a room, everyone bows. And they say, 'Your Grace,' and they kiss his ring." And a third woman said, "That's nothing. My son is a cardinal. When he comes into a room, people grovel on the floor. And they call him 'Your Eminence.'" And they looked to the fourth woman, and she was just sipping her latte and had to wait for her to respond. "Well, what about your son then?" And he said, "That's nothing. My son is an ex-Eagles player. He's 6'4" tall, a blonde, blue-eyed, a self-made millionaire. When he comes into a room, all the women fade and say, 'Oh, my God, my God.'" So that's what really counts, isn't it? I remember going to the old Hollywood school some years ago. It's a big takedown now. They're having this different religions coming once every week. And I was at the last one, the Buddhist talk. And the teacher said, "I'm sorry, sort of, you failed." I said, "Why was that?" He said, "Last week they had this Muslim guy. He was, again, 6'2", blue-eyed and blonde." He said, you Buddhist monks don't cut the ice with the girls." But anyway, the point is, with spiritual elitism, there's too much of it about it. We should actually stop all this elitism, who's the best and who's the worst, and just instead just practice the path of virtue, peace, and wisdom. And that can create more happiness in this world. It can open us up to wisdom coming from different sources. It can stop this terrible thing of I'm the best and I'm the worst, and all the terrible things which come of it, of exploitation, of power, of trying to oppress other religions, because I think ours is the best and yours is the worst. So if I have to go and ban you, I've got to stop you, become violent to you, blow up your temples, or whatever else you have to do, all because of spiritual elitism. And then for your own practical life, please be friendly with other traditions. If another teacher comes along, listen to them. They may be, don't care where they come from, man or woman, gay or whatever. Listen to them, see what they have to say. If it makes sense, then it's just another great teacher in this great school of life. In the great university, you can learn something from them. Don't just commit to one teacher, because every teacher will have weaknesses and others strengths. In the time of the Buddha, they had his two great disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana. Moggallana was just so great on the deep meditations. Sariputta was so great in understanding the wisdom of that. The two of them together made a great team. By themselves, they probably wouldn't have made it. Together, they were great. This is why that sometimes you need more than one teacher. And that's sometimes safe as well. So don't just depend upon one. Two or three, we can balance each other. And that way, we don't even compare. Everything becomes useful for us. And it's terrible spiritual elitism of our world. If you come across it, whoever says, you know, that I'm the supreme, this is the best way, don't go to other people's way, the red warning lights should start flashing. The alarm bells should start going. There's something wrong there. It feels wrong, and actually it is wrong. So let's end the spiritual elitism. Don't really judge a person from what religion they come from, what part of the religion they come from, what gender they are. Just listen to what they say. If it makes sense, and it's according with your experience, and it leads to peace, to freedom, to tolerance, to this beautiful unconditional awareness called love, then you can follow it. That's how you know truth. We can cut across and cut out this terrible aristocracy of religions. So that's the talk for this evening. The end of spiritual elitism. Okay, anyone got any comments or questions about this evening's talk? Hope you don't think it was the best talk. Certainly not the worst. Not the same, it's just the talk, that's all. Any questions? Gone. Okay. So at least you remember the jokes anyway. Especially the Cottesloe Four Ladies joke. That went down very well.
Thank you very much, mein Führer. Just kidding. Actually, no, it's not true. He's not a spiritual dictator. In all the time I've known him, he's not once has he told me what to do, even though there are plenty of times
it.
He was
I
thinking
about it. Yeah.
Okay, no, he's very gentle. And he always says, "Plex." It's